So our topic for today, we organize several sessions throughout the year on different topics. We have a sign-up sheet if you're not already on our mailing list, or visit us online to learn more about our upcoming events. Our topic for today is race and epistemic marginalization in science. So we have four fabulous speakers lined up. So without further ado, I'll introduce our first speaker this afternoon. She's Christy Dotson, who is a professor of philosophy at Michigan State University. She has a joint appointment in African American and African Studies. She's an expert on feminist philosophy, epistemology, and critical race theory. In addition to dozens of articles, she has co-edited with Robert Bernasconi a three-volume collection, Race, Hybridity, and Miscegenation, and more recently edited a special issue of Hypatia on interstices, inheriting women of color feminist philosophy. Today she's going to be speaking to us on the topic of considering the scope of epistemic oppression. Please join me in welcoming Professor Dotson.
Well, thank you very much for coming out. The sun's coming out. Sun wasn't out yesterday, so I know the burden. I know. I got rained on yesterday. So I imagine that the role that I have in this series, particularly this particular series, this one right here, is to talk about epistemic oppression, not necessarily science, because it's kind of not my background. And because I don't want to disappoint anybody, I won't talk about science. I will talk mostly about epistemic oppression. And at this time, I'm working on a manuscript entitled Varieties of Epistemic Oppression for Oxford. Today, I want to share a bit of that project with you. And for those of you with a trained ear, you're probably groaning a little bit on the inside. Because if someone's working on a book project, that means one of two things. Either it's going to be too specific, or it's going to be too broad. I promise to be a little bit of both. But I will have an example at the back end that helps you understand some of the theory that I'm going to be articulating. And there's a lot of theory. It's front-loaded theory, but there's going to be a Q&A, and there will be an example that I hope helps you understand what I'm doing, what my approach is. So the example I'll be giving comes from an Author Meets Critics that was at the APA Pacific this past week on Sandra Harding's book, recent book, Objectivity and Diversity, Another Logic of Scientific Inquiry. So I might say something about science, and that's what I'm gonna conclude with. So let's talk about what is epistemic oppression. First, I think on my account, epistemic oppression refers to persistent epistemic exclusion that hinders one's contribution to social knowledge production. So persistent epistemic exclusion that hinders one's contribution to social knowledge production. Epistemic exclusion here refers to unwarranted infringement of epistemic agency of knowers. And epistemic agency, then, in this analysis, refers to the ability to utilize persuasively shared epistemic resources within a given community of knowers in order to fully participate in these communities. And what I mean by fully participate, I mean fully participate at the level of knowledge possession, who has knowledge, knowledge acquisition, how you can pursue it, who has access to it, knowledge attribution, who we think knows it, who possesses it, knowledge production, coming together as groups to actually produce further knowledge, its generation, and knowledge creation, which to me is different because there are conditions, there are legitimacy standards and what in epistemology we call justificatory conditions for knowledge production itself. To me, there's a story to be told about how knowledge is created, right? What actually counts as knowledge at any given point. So, and I mean, when I say that, our epistemic agency with respect to all these different phases actually looks different, but it can be compromised with respect to all these different phases, right? So that's what I think about in terms of robust kind of contribution to knowledge, to social knowledge production. So I know that's a lot. So I'm gonna roll back a little bit and outline some of the assumptions I'm making in these definitions. And then I'll return to an understanding of epistemic exclusion, oppression, and agency, so we can get an idea of the scope of what I am talking about. I'll look at three orders of epistemic oppression, and then offer an example, a real live example that happened last weekend of what it looks like on the ground, what it actually looks like. So there are three grounding assumptions for this account, which can be found in much of feminist epistemologies. They concern, one, the situatedness of knowers, two, the interdependence of our epistemic resources, and three, the resilience of our epistemological comportment. And I'm going to explain these in turn. So, in her article, Relational Knowing and Epistemic Injustice, Gail Paul House Jr. argues that situatedness and interdependence constitute two epistemically significant aspects of the social natures of knowing. Paul House writes, quote, "The knower's situatedness refers to situations in which the knower finds herself repeatedly over time due to the social relations that position her in the world. The situatedness develops particular habits of attention that may attune the knower and other to the knower to others' habits of attention or not, depending on one's social vulnerability. Social position has a bearing on what parts of the world are prominent to the knower and what parts of the world are not," end quote. That one's social position can and often does shape what parts of the world to which we attend is not a new revelation. Donna Haraway, in her article, Situated Knowledges, articulates the situatedness of knowers with the metaphor of vision. By appealing to the embodiment of all vision, Haraway emphasizes that one's vision can give the illusion of being infinite vision. However, as she emphasizes, no one's vision is infinite insofar as it's embodied, it's directed as a result of this embodiment. To say that knowers are situated is to say that one's capacity for knowing is not infinite, but is rather directed by significant features of one's existence. For example, one's embodiment, or as Paul House highlights, one's social positionality. Like how our embodiment confines and directs our vision at any given time, our social positions can both confine and direct our habits of attention, which can have a profound effect on what we come to know, especially concerning social knowledge. Some of the best, or some of the pushbacks against situated knowers take, I think, as a paradigm understanding of knowledge, that of the physical world, in terms of, is this a podium, is this a, you know, a table, those kinds of things. And even though I think that's gonna be a really complicated story, I think it oversimplifies what it means to actually construct knowledge of a social world. It's not as if there are objects in space looking like, I mean, presenting itself that particular kind of way. So there's far more give and take on what situatedness allows us to see with respect to our social worlds, right? The second feature of our epistemological landscape concerns the social nature of knowing is interdependence. Knowing itself requires the use of collective epistemic resources. Paul House writes, quote, "Knowing requires resources of the mind, such as language to formulate propositions, concepts to make sense of experience, procedures to approach the world, and standards to judge particular accounts of experience. We need epistemic resources for making sense of and evaluating our experiences," end quote. So many epistemologists share the observation that epistemic resources on which we rely and make sense of our worlds are collective. We get born into them, we're raised in them, they're just kind of how we see. The difference between one's situatedness and one's interdependence maps on the difference between what one knows and how one knows it, for Paul House. Where one's situatedness concerns what one is in the position to know, interdependence concerns how one is able to know it. This distinction between what and how one knows, along with the corresponding ideas, that we are all situated interdependent knowers, identify sites for certain kinds of harmful epistemic exclusions. Right? And I'll return to this. But the third and last feature of our landscapes I want to introduce here, epistemic landscapes, concerns the resilience of our epistemological comportment. Right? So epistemological comportment here refers to operative, anything, I guess, the conditions for the possibility of knowing anything at all. Things like operative instituted social imaginaries, habits of cognition, attitudes towards knowers, any relevant sensibility that encourages or hinders the production of social knowledge. It concerns one's overall epistemic life ways, and I'll keep referring to this. To explain further, I mean, let me give you an understanding or just an example out of operative instituted social imaginaries to demonstrate this idea of an epistemic or epistemological comportment. So an instituted social imaginary, there's so many versions of it, the one I'm going to be taking, are more than a repository of images that aid in sharing information. They create and maintain normative social expectations of reasoning and seeing the world that are internalized to generate standards for success and benchmarks of rightness. It's kind of like a sensibility. There's so many different versions of this. The one that I'm using comes from a 2008 paper of mine. But actually, I'm really trying to say that there's a sense when we think someone's got something right. I'm like, You know what I mean? Like, okay, okay. And we actually say, that's right, that's right. Even if it's new information, we kind of nod with it. Okay, okay. It has clicked off some boxes for us, not all of which are, in some ways, have we actually brought to language, but there is an orientation, a set of sensibilities that actually satisfies. Those things are inherited in some ways. I wanted to call those kind of instituted social imaginaries that actually have these benchmarks for success and rightness. When they're triggered, then we start asking questions like, what kind of reasons do we have for that? Which is not necessarily part of what it meant not to be triggered, you see. That we ask reasons, that's actually later down the line of this kind of account. Right? It didn't pass our social imaginary, let's just say. It didn't pass the instituted social imaginary, and farther down the line, we got to the point where now we can start asking for things like justification. But there's lots of things we just kind of take in prior to any production of reasons, justification, or evidence. That, to me, there are such things. They have epistemic operations, let's just say. As such, instituted social imaginaries provide the grounds for legitimation conditions. It is important to note that instituted social imaginaries are not always shared in common across entire populations. There are resistant epistemic and communicative practices of non-dominant subjects that serve to ensure, at the very least, that there are multiple instituted social imaginaries operative at any given time. Hence, though a social imaginary itself is not an epistemic compartment, and that's for those of you who really know that the difference. An operative instituted social imaginary is very much tied to social positioning and the epistemic resources of the knower themselves. I think it should be included in something called epistemic lifeways, the ways in which we encounter the world as subjects trying to know something. So epistemic lifeways then simply refers to the conditions for the possibility of knowledge, production, scription, possession, attribution, creation, the whole knowledge project, of which operative instituted social imaginaries are but one among many factors that make up our general conduct with respect to these things. I'm gonna say these lifeways are resilient. Resilient primarily because 90% of them aren't conscious. They were not actually tracking. Just things that we've kind of been raised in, if they get triggered, we may look at them. But they're resilient here, I think, in a way, where the kind of magnitude of disturbance that they can take without actually restructuring themselves is actually quite strong. To say that our epistemological comportment is highly resilient is to say that it can absorb extraordinarily large disturbances without redefining its structure. So resilience here has at least two factors. It refers to the scope of a given domain where a confluence of factors operate in stable ways, and the magnitude of disturbances required to force change or adaptation in a given operative context. Both our situated perspectives, our collective epistemic resources, aid in shaping our epistemological comportment, our epistemic lifeways, and these factors combine to shape stable domains, stable habits. If they weren't stable, we couldn't know. The ways in which we can actually shift, we can say, oh wait, something's different is happening. It's different off the backdrop of the things that hold stable. I don't have to tell people philosophy of science that. There are things that have to hold stable. We can't know if they didn't, right? Now, ultimately, that resilience is going to actually be something of a problem. So, give an example of this. Medina offers an example of resilient epistemological comportment, or what I'm calling epistemological resilience, when he draws attention to the role instituted social imaginaries play in the production of ignorance. In his essay, quote, "The relevance of credibility excesses in proportional view of epistemic injustice." Medina outlines a connection between social imaginaries, poor epistemic habits, active ignorance, and a kind of form of meta-ignorance. Instituted social imaginaries, without what Medina describes epistemic friction, lead to a number of poor epistemic habits. Without the propensity to actively search for more alternatives than those noticed, and to engage those alternatives, one runs the risk of fostering and maintaining ignorance and meta-ignorance. In other words, without routine engagement in instituted social imaginary activities, when we're refining your sense of which ones those are, one runs the risk of maintaining unacceptable levels of ignorance. Now, meta-ignorance from Medina concerns being unable to detect one's inability to understand certain things. It's not just not understanding. It's actually unable to detect that you didn't understand. Right? If there is such a thing as epistemic lifeways, this is not something, well, I don't even know. Look, if we've never run across the person who has that problem, good on you. But we've seen it, right? This kind of insensitivity to the limits of one's instituted social imaginaries fosters and maintains poor epistemic habits like epistemic laziness, closed-mindedness, and a kind of epistemic arrogance we should all try to avoid. Now, what is important to note about Medina's analysis is how his account of meta-ignorance and epistemic friction point to the resilience of our epistemological conduct. If there isn't something that shifts us, we don't shift. Right? But there actually has to be some instability introduced into our epistemological conduct for there to be some kind of significant shifts in our epistemological life ways. Right? To me, that resilience is going to be a site by which we can identify something like epistemic oppression. Maybe a condition for the possibility of knowledge, but it is the condition for the possibility of ignorance too. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on a little bit. Now, where situatedness and interdependence can account for some of the ways our epistemological comportment is social, resilience tracks the possibility of changing our general comportment in light of those features. So these are the assumptions that I'm putting forward. I'm going to track some conceptions of epistemic oppression that actually come off of these kinds of ideas. So let's return to those earlier definitions. I'll say them again, and this time get a little flesh on them, given these kinds of assumptions. So with these assumptions in place, let's return to the earlier definitions of epistemic exclusion and epistemic oppression. So epistemic oppression, again, refers to persistent epistemic exclusion that hinders one's contribution to social knowledge production. Epistemic exclusion here refers to unwarranted infringement on the epistemic agencies of knowers. An epistemic agency in this analysis refers to the ability to utilize persuasively shared epistemic resources within a given community of knowers in order to fully participate in those communities. And I talked about this in terms of knowledge possession, knowledge acquisition, knowledge attribution, knowledge production, and if required, knowledge creation. Those are definitions. So let's take them together then. Epistemic oppression refers to persistent and unwarranted inability to utilize persuasively shared epistemic resources that hinders one's contribution to social knowledge production in a very robust sense. One can identify epistemic oppression along the lines of situatedness, interdependence, and epistemological resilience, and that's what we're going to do right now. I call these like three orders of epistemic oppression. There's a reason for that that won't come up in this particular paper, but if you have a question about that, I can tell you why I call them that. So, first order epistemic oppression that tracks onto something like situatedness. Recall that an epistemic exclusion is an unwarranted infringement on epistemic agency of knowers, which reduces her or his ability to participate in the social production of knowledge. So the first kind of epistemic exclusion that I'm going to say can lead to epistemic oppression follows from a persistent compromise of one's epistemic agency due to the inefficiency within epistemic resources, a kind of inefficiency. That is, a first order epistemic exclusion is an exclusion that results from incompetent functioning of some aspect of shared epistemic resources. Shared standards, for example, shared standards, shared language, some particular goal. Now, this is a problem from within one situated perspective. I'm going to take the example of credibility here because I think it's a really good one. People are committed to the notion that credibility does work for us epistemically, but there are problems. We can have problems with respect to credibility that actually come from the fact that we're not very good at distributing credibility well. Which is not good at this. People think they're good at this, but they're not. So Nancy Tawana, in her article, The Spectrum of Ignorance, writes, quote, "What feminist epistemologists and science, feminist epistemologists and science studies theorists have carefully demonstrated is that our theories of knowledge and knowledge practices are far from democratic, maintaining criteria for credibility that favors members of privileged groups," end quote. While criteria or standards of credibility create and favor privileged groups, they also create and negatively affect relatively underprivileged groups. As Medina explains, conferrals of credibility have a contrastive nature. He writes, "Being judged credible to some degree is being regarded as more credible than others, less credible than others still, and equally as credible as some people." This assures that there are real stakes to standards of credibility. However, to those who believe their credibility to be compromised, those words will sound, but when people think that someone's credibility is compromised, they have something like the curse of Cassandra, if you will. I don't know if you remember this story, but the curse of Cassandra is when I think Apollo, I mean, there's all kinds of different versions of it, but you know, the stripped down version is Apollo gives Cassandra the ability to predict the future and then removes her believability, right? So that she comes and she says exactly what is going to happen, but nobody believes her. Sounds like lies. Sounds like unreliable statements, right? When you have a credibility deficit, in a moment, you got the curse of Cassandra. You actually can know what's going to happen. You can actually have a good sense of what's going on, but people just don't believe you. Your credibility is somehow compromised, right? This, I'm gonna say, is a problem. Hopefully you're gonna say that too. It's difficult to impossible to break out of this kind of epistemic exclusion when one's epistemic capacity to engage in a given community is compromised to the degree where one's situatedness works against one's participation in knowledge production. How you're being perceived, as you're being perceived, is working against you. The people most profoundly able to dispel the myths around one's credibility deficits are also the victim of those credibility deficits due to how damaging such deficits can be within a given epistemic community. The more widely shared the low credibility assessments are concerning disadvantaged epistemic identities, the more likely they are to be difficult to address, right? As an example of persisting epistemic exclusion that compromises one's ability to contribute to social knowledge production, unwarranted devaluations of credibility and the creation of epistemic disadvantaged identities are an example of epistemic oppression. First order, as far as I'm concerned. What makes this a kind of first order epistemic oppression, however, is the catalyst for this kind of epistemic exclusion. Unwarranted credibility deficits are inefficiencies. Look, we don't necessarily have to change our value of credibility as much as we have to change the inefficiency with which we distribute it. Something wrong the ways in which we distribute something like credibility, right? Now, we may think we have to change it, but it's not clear to me that that's precisely what one has to do to address it. There's an inefficient practice, right? We have a shared value and an inefficient practice, as far as I'm concerned. That's first order, to me, probably the easiest to address, because we have a shared value. When the values start coming apart, then it gets really hairy. So second order epistemic oppression then that will actually come off something like interdependence. So a second order epistemic exclusion actually results from insufficient shared epistemic resources. Now to say that a shared epistemic resource, set of resources are insufficient, is to point to limitations within the shared epistemic resources themselves. They're not malfunctioning, they're not inefficient, they just can't get the job done. Whatever the job is, right? They are functioning fine, but given the goals of the knowers or the community of knowers, they have somehow become insufficient. In this case, usually a second order exclusion can actually point to a gap between what one's epistemic resources detect and what one wants one's epistemic resources to detect. This happens all the time. We start building out new ways of understanding things and new ways of actually pursuing knowledge. The gap, however, results from the kind of always already present exclusion that is identifiable according to the insufficient nature of the epistemic resources themselves. An example of a second order epistemic exclusion would be something like Miranda Fricker's understanding of hermeneutical injustice, where some significant range of experiences are obscured from collective understanding due to gaps within interdependent epistemic resources themselves, right? This is Fricker's conception. The example she used is a sexual harassment example, and the idea is this. Folks were experiencing sexual harassment long before it became a term, and certainly long before there was anything like the legal structure that exists around it right now, right? I mean, so she's gonna use this as an example. Like, we have these things come up all the time, but we have a set of experiences that are constantly happening, but we don't necessarily have the terms for them, or there are hermeneutic gaps in our collective resources that helps us, makes it so that the experience is obscure, but more than that, the ability to communicate it is actually less, right? So, hermeneutic gaps in our collective epistemic resources are second order exclusions that result from and are addressed by, in many ways, the interdependent nature of our epistemic lifeways. If left unaddressed, a second order epistemic exclusion can persist indefinitely. In the cases of second order exclusions, the malformed epistemic resources in question function just fine for a significant portion of the population. The people who aren't experiencing that don't see any problems. Like, this works just fine. This tells me what's happening here, blah, 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 blah. I'm not experiencing that, what else? It's good, right? Those whose experiences are obscured by operating epistemic resources are in the position of having to challenge the very resources that many believe are reliable and are generally well-functioning, right? Collective epistemic resources can and do function well enough in order to produce knowledge because they wouldn't actually become collective and shared if they didn't work. They work. Just don't work in all cases, right? So there's something about, I think, the challenge of a second order epistemic oppression, something that like that can actually persist because the resources are actually working fine. for lots and lots and lots of people. And then there are folks it's not working fine for. And the fight of that is often the fight of the interdependence. You're in the community, you're in it with the other folks. The experiences, for example, sexual harassment, is happening, getting people to see it, coming up with the language for it. It's one that actually is part of community building itself. You're actually in the community, you're in the proximity, you're in a certain kind of proximity with folks where that process of coming to language is probably going to be fruitful given that you're all in the same community. It's insufficient, the resources are insufficient right then. However, its sufficiency can actually be resulted or at very least addressed with interdependence itself. We are interdependent, right? Not all forms of exclusion can be addressed that way. This is one of the things I want to stop because I think to hear lots of epistemologists, lots of epistemic oppression theorists get, I think, this far, and they're gonna say, so interdependence can save everything. I'm gonna introduce a third one that says interdependence can't do shit about it. That's not actually gonna help us. This one, I think people get this far, but there is one more, which to me is far more common and far worse, that says that interdependence can't actually be a solution, right? But that second order epistemic oppression, I think, follows from the reality that while collective epistemic resources illuminate some aspects of our world, they simultaneously can work to obscure other aspects. Just because they're collective doesn't make them infinite. So there's the question of the finite nature of our ability to know anything, the level of the subject and level of collective, that actually opens up room for something like epistemic oppression. So the third kind of epistemic exclusion, a third order exclusion, is a compromise to epistemic agency caused by inadequate shared epistemic resources. Now, to say that resources are inadequate is to throw into question the relevance of the entire set of shared epistemic resources itself for knowledge production in a particular domain. Unlike insufficient epistemic resources, where one can actually point to the actual gap, the lacuna, the problem, given one's goals, inadequate epistemic resources bars this kind of recognition. They're inadequate for grappling with whatever one, actually I don't even think people have this as a goal. Where insufficient epistemic resources say that we have a goal that puts us out of line. Inadequate is actually even beyond the grasp of that. One might have a goal that is outside the scope of one's resources, but one's resources are inadequate for the task, and I'm not certain that's actually a requirement. The inadequacy in question results from the epistemological resilience of one's life ways, that there are actually things in the world that the ways in which we have come to understand knowledge disallows us from seeing, detecting, much less knowing, right? Much less knowing. I will talk, my example here will actually talk very seriously about what it is we can imagine we can learn from indigenous knowledges from a Western perspective. Worrisome. Seriously worrisome. And that's kind of where we're going to go here with objectivity and diversity. With inadequate resources, the kind of changes necessary to one's operative epistemic life ways in order to actually correct for it would be extensive, momentous even, the kind of disturbances that one might say, I don't know, cataclysmic. This makes inadequacy hard to detect in most cases, but even if you're capable of detecting it, it's almost impossible to address. Now that's what I want to motivate here. It's a question of can you actually address this kind of problem? So to do that, let's turn to the often meets critics example. And I'll give this is the example I'll use. I'll build out an example of first order, second, and third order that all existed in this often meets critics last week. So I'm gonna turn away from that, took a bit of theory, to the example that I'm gonna use to try and put some meat on these bones. So in objectivity and diversity, oh, by the way, I was one of the critics on the panel. So I wasn't like sitting in the audience. I was one of the critics as a part of the paper. Sandra asked me to do this and I was glad to, and then we had this moment. So we'll see. In objectivity and diversity, Harding has one general project. That is to show that objectivity and certain kinds of diversity can be mutually supported, end quote. In supporting this claim, that she calls the mutual support claim, Harding explains that she plans to do, quote, bridge work between recent feminist post-colonial and post-Kuhnian science studies thinking. And to do this bridge work, she puts forward six arguments and at least two distinctive positions with respect to the mutual support claim. Now remember, the mutual support claim is the idea that diversity and objectivity can be mutually supportive of one another, right? These six arguments include, one, The first argument is that Harding's own conception of strong objectivity identifies the logic of the mutual support claim. That is to say that, quote, in at least some cases, scientific and philosophical research can be directed by recognizably political, social, and cultural values of interest, and yet still be fair to the evidence and fair to its severest critics, end quote, right? So she's gonna say that objectivity has these goals, several goals, two of which being fair to the evidence and fair to severest critics, and she's gonna say something about diversity, political, social, and cultural values actually can help uphold objectivity. The second argument is an argument for how political commitments, that is starting from the daily lives of the poorest women in the global South, can lead to maximally objective scientific research and results. The third argument is aimed at highlighting a valuable world of multiple sciences, referred to at several points in the text as the world of sciences. These world of sciences are intricately tied to different social and cultural worlds. Now, the argument in this chapter, which is chapter 4, will be the basis of my example. Because there she uses the reliability of many of the assumptions and practices of indigenous knowledge systems to indicate that there are many kinds of sciences that are socially and culturally rich, but also reliable and strongly objective. The fourth argument locates the value embeddedness of logical positivism. She's gonna say that logical positivism has a social and political embeddedness in kind of Western scientific modes. McCarthyism comes up. Five, the fifth argument highlights the importance of the religious and secular values in the development of Western sciences, the idea that secularism is always off the backdrop of kind of religiosity, a particular kind. What makes something secular is a certain conception of the religious. And hence, they go hand in hand in some interesting ways. So she's gonna say, the cultural and religious embeddedness of what we think of as Western science, she makes an argument for that. The fifth and the sixth and final argument articulates a central observation guiding the entire text, which is sciences and societies co-produce and co-constitute each other, end quote. So this equiprimordiality of science and society, she's gonna say social, political, religious, cultural, and secularistic particularities actually end up producing science and societies together, right? It's a good book, actually. This is moment though, I'm gonna talk about it, but overall, it's a good book. These arguments carry forward two overall positions present in objectivity and diversity. Given that science and societies co-produce and co-constitute each other, we ought to be thinking, one, about what kind of sciences that we want for today's multicultural democratic societies, and two, what kind of new scientific selves will be required for such sciences. That's the whole point of the book. So Harding proposes that we need to embrace a disunified and plural world of sciences and cultivate scientific selves that include multiple and conflicting subjectivities, capable of changing one's mind and plans in response to, and as being a result of, dynamic knowing communities. And that is that's her new book in a nutshell. I presented that to her, she said I was right. So, here you have it. In my estimation, some of the riskier parts of Harding's book come in chapter 4. It's entitled, quote, "Do Micronesian Navigators Practice Science?" End quote. Yeah, I know. Some people already caught that. In this chapter, Harding argues that indigenous knowledge systems inhabit valuable versions of objectivity and proceeds to attempt to identify, in her own words, quote, "the benefits to indigenous peoples and to educated Westerners of regarding indigenous knowledge systems as full sciences, and thus leveling the epistemological playing field in illuminating ways," end quote. So she's gonna outline five reasons indigenous peoples benefit from their own knowledge systems, that's a direct quote, and four benefits that the West, now she used the West throughout this, I'm gonna use it too, but it's scare quotes in my draft, you can't see that. The West received from indigenous knowledge systems and four possible relationships between them. Now see, to see the riskiness of this, I am gonna list the benefits because it's gonna be important for my story about epistemic oppression in the back. So Sandra explains, or Harding explains, that indigenous peoples benefit from indigenous knowledges in at least five ways. They include one, the benefit of empirical reliability and the predictive capacities of indigenous knowledges. Two, the benefit of preserving local environments with indigenous knowledges. Three, Some will benefit from indigenous knowledges due to the relatively remoteness of indigenous societies. I find that one interesting because it's like remoteness is a feature of the world. No, I don't think so. It's actually built into it. Anyway, 4, the benefits that result from how indigenous knowledges serve as keepers of cultural values and creativity. And 5, benefits that follow from indigenous knowledge systems being political resources. Those are the 5 benefits. By contrast, the West benefits from indigenous knowledges in 4 ways. They include the ability to learn new facts about nature and social relations from other cultures' knowledge systems. This is all direct quotes at this point. Enables the capacity to explore unfamiliar logics of nature's order of research, to further develop the ethics and politics of research, and then 4, identify new perspectives on the limitations of modern Western sciences. Now this may seem like a perfectly innocent list. However, the benefits that the West receives from indigenous knowledges are almost entirely instrumental. And it is not altogether clear that the benefits that indigenous peoples receive on this list is not simply the ability to fend off the West. That is to say, it's very easy to read this listing and see indigenous knowledges understood in terms of a life and death struggle with the West, as opposed to a life-affirming practice with indigenous peoples, and to imagine its value as being purely instrumental for Western science, right? Now, this attempt to level the epistemological playing field while identifying benefits for indigenous knowledges where there are no indigenous people cited, I just want to say that, but it's important. And what Harding calls the West is risky in many ways. For example, Harding recognizes the risk entailed in executing this kind of analysis when she explains that labeling indigenous knowledges as sciences could be seen as a form of problematic Eurocentric appropriation, her term. And a nod that someone might read her text as just, her term, one more piece of European appropriation is a nod to the riskiness of the endeavor of putting Western sciences in conversation with indigenous knowledges in this way. But it is also a nod to the insufficient nature of the notion of sciences as applied to indigenous knowledges, right? And that term should ring a bell. It's an insufficient concept, right? I'm still gonna use it though. Why? We know it's insufficient. You acknowledge it to the insufficient nature of it, but we're still going to use it. This did not dissuade Harding from using it, and the failure to genuinely acknowledge the insufficient nature of her term, the conceptual resources that come with it, meant that she ran the risk of second-order epistemic oppression, reifying existing hermeneutic gaps between Western sciences and indigenous knowledge systems. Right? That second-order kind. I'll return to this shortly. Harding also held the goal of being fair to the evidence and its strongest critics, which is part and parcel with Western objectivity. This kind of value is a result of her situatedness. She's like, I'm from the West. I believe in objectivity. Some questions to consider with respect to the picture of epistemic oppression I've been laying out for you concerns the possible inefficiency with respect to the value of being fair to the evidence and one's critics and, critiques. And whether the insufficiencies of Harding's epistemic resources will be handled so as to lessen the hermeneutic gaps that she identifies exist between Western science and indigenous knowledges. And whether the account she gave further refined those epistemic exclusions as opposed to just furthering them. In at least these ways, Harding's text was risky. Risky in terms of its flirtation with epistemic oppression. Some of those risks included, but are not limited to, reestablishing and reifying existing relationships that instrumentalize indigenous knowledges and resources for the sake of the progress of Western sciences. I'm going to think of this as a first order epistemic oppression. Why? There is so much evidence, there is so much work on so many fronts about the error of understanding relationships to indigenous knowledges and peoples, particularly the set of colonial state, in terms of its instrumental value. There's so much work on this. Like, you don't have to agree with it. You do have to account for it. There has to be some way in which you've been fair to your critics, right? There's an inefficiency in her account because they're never mentioned and they're never brought up. Never. And yet there's so much work on this, so much scholarship. The second one is over-determining indigenous knowledge systems with Western understandings of science. This is when she acknowledges herself. Like, you may think that I'm doing bad with this, and I might be, but I want to level the playing field. Well, that's a second order epistemic oppression. You know it's ill-fitting. You know it's insufficient. You use it anyway. I don't understand that one. As it reifies the gap between those two things. The third is framing indigenous resilience and resurgence as an issue of Western dominion and Western legacies of destruction. This third one, I'm gonna call a third order epistemic oppression. There is no mention of colonial legacies. There's no mention of indigenous timelines that would see their own knowledge systems, as Kyle White explains in his work, as having governance value that extended before colonial expansion and will end long after the West dashed its flailing infancy on this new global ordering. Strikes me, there was no attempt to imagine what this would look like from the perspective of somebody who was actually indigenous. It's not clear she could do it, yo. I mean, that's the thing. That's the part about third order. It's not clear she could take that up. But should you attempt to identify the benefits of something for someone who is not you, you need to be able to perform that. Part of the goal. Now remember, this third order epistemic oppression is actually coming off of a goal she, in fact, in this case, set for herself. I'm not saying everybody has to do it, but if you are going to, as part of your argument, identify the benefits for someone who you're not in the group of, you need to figure out how to do that for real. Not for fake. And it's not clear you can do it. Now, this is what I'm going to acknowledge. It's not clear you can. But if there is no mention of colonial legacies, if indigenous timelines are not actually considered, and Western timelines of colonial expansion are the only ones we can imagine, it is not clear that one has fully appreciated the harm a framework like that does for shaping the narrative in such a way where entire perspectives are no longer relevant. All right. That worries me. It seemed clear to me that Harding's painstaking work to highlight the political, religious, and secular forces that helped to shape Western science, this is her term, not mine, goes a long way to saying that Western science is by no means an apolitical, irreligious, institution, if it is one. Several of the six arguments I outlined have that effect. Part of the performance of Harding's text is to say that Western sciences are no different than indigenous knowledges insofar as science and societies co-produce each other. This kind of leveling of the epistemological playing field, as Harding identifies as one of her goals, has risks when you are not necessarily capable of thinking through the other populations and the epistemic differences that make a difference. So first order epistemic oppression, kind of exclusion, as a result of ineffective epistemic resources, exists because Harding has the expressed value of being true to the evidence and one's critics. But there are a lot of critics and bodies of evidence in the world that would have made the reifying of the problematic instrumentalization of indigenous knowledge systems an issue. And she's gonna say in her response to me, it's just a little instrumentalization. I don't know what that means. That sounds like a little pregnant to me. I don't know how that works. Second order epistemic oppression, epistemic exclusion that results from insufficient epistemic resources, exists because Harding's failure to seriously consider what harms certain frames cause and their inability to capture differences that make a difference and thereby reifying those gaps. And I mean by what she already understands is a problematic deployment of science. Third order epistemic oppression, exclusion as a result of the resilience of our epistemic lifeways. Because of the neglected impact of the history of colonial expansion, the resource stripping of the West with respect to indigenous lands, peoples, and resources, made it so that her entire framework facilitated an obliviousness to how those considerations impact how we might talk about, how we might approach, and what kind of expectations we ought to have with respect to indigenous knowledges. Without that kind of sensitivity, the ability to discern inadequacies doesn't necessarily exist, but the inadequacies stay, whether we know it or not, whether we can hear it or not. I suppose that's my conclusion. There are many different ways to understand epistemic oppression, and it appears to me it can come from even the most unlikely of places. Thank you.